saving money on everything for your next project. Now at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of bagged concrete and mortar mixes. Whether you're pouring a walkway, concrete slab, or setting a post, we have the right product at the best price to complete your project. Shop our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
When Nancy Guthrie disappeared from her Tucson home, the first people through the door were supposed to be the best the Pima County Sheriff's Office had. Instead, according to reporting that has emerged since, what showed up was a homicide sergeant with no homicide experience, an understaffed detective squad, and veteran investigators who could have helped were left on the sideline, allegedly. The most critical hours of the investigation, which, as we all know, are the hours right after the crime was committed. The first 48 TV shows about it. The hours that determine whether a case gets solved or goes cold were handled by people who weren't ready for what was in front of them. That's what this series is all about. This week, five cases where the wrong people were in the room at the worst possible moment. Five families who paid the price. Nancy's story threads through every one of them because the failure that may be shaping her case has been destroying cases for decades. This, my friends, is part one. And as we go through these cases, as we discuss all of these failures in these well-known scenarios, I'd love to get your thoughts and feedback in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Start here. Someone wiped down the kitchen counters. That's the detail that should keep every investigator in America up at night about this other case. This other case takes place back in time, December 26, 1996. A six-year-old girl is dead in the basement of her family's home in Boulder, Colorado. And upstairs in what is, by definition, an active crime scene, a victim's advocate is tidying the kitchen. Spray cleaner on the counters, friends milling in and out, coffee being served, a minister offering comfort. And somewhere in that chaos, on those counters, in the oils and fibers, and prints left behind by whoever moved through that house the night before, evidence is being erased in real time. Not by a criminal covering tracks, by well-meaning people who had no idea what they were standing in at that moment in time. The middle of a murder case, because nobody in the room told them. And it's 1996, and, you know, I can't say we're pre-Dateline era, but Dateline was not Dateline. Dateline was doing stories about shitty car dealerships and things like that. It wasn't the true crime television program it is today. And there's no YouTube, and there's no true crimers out there. It doesn't exist, really. So the education that I guess our society has today on a crime scene is far greater than it was in 1996 as a whole. Whereas I wouldn't expect everybody in there to be like, oh, well, we shouldn't be doing this. But today, you might have a couple going, this is a crime scene. Back then, well, whatever Officer Friendly tells us to do, right? That's 1996. A lot of ignorance in the face of obvious scenarios. There's a lot of it. Keep going back in history. It gets worse. That image, the wiped counters, the open front door, the uncontrolled parade of visitors is where the JonBenet Ramsey case began to die. Not in a courtroom, not in a lab, in a kitchen before the body was even found. This is where it is always so important that investigators, the people who are in charge, take charge and know what the hell they are doing. Don't expect the citizens to do the right thing or even know what to do. If you've been following the Nancy Guthrie case, and I know most of you have, that's probably why you're here, this should feel a little familiar. Not the specifics, but the structure. When the wrong people are running the scene, the damage doesn't announce itself. It happens quietly. A sergeant dispatched to a case beyond their experience, a search plane pilot reassigned, veteran detectives silenced. In Tucson, the initial response to Nancy's disappearance raised serious questions about whether the people making the critical early decisions had the qualifications the moment demanded. In Boulder, three decades earlier, the same fundamental failure played out in a different house, in a different state, with the same devastating result. The first hours were handled by people who weren't ready. And the case has never recovered. It is unsolved to this day. Boulder in 1996 was not a city that expected murder. It was affluent, progressive, tucked against the foothills with a university campus and a downtown that felt more like a college town than a place where violent crime happened. The police department reflected that reality. Homicide experience was close to non-existent. The district attorney preferred negotiated pleas to courtroom trials. This was a community that had the luxury of not needing seasoned murder investigators, because murders almost never happened there. Then Patsy Ramsey called 911 on the morning of December 26 and reported that her six-year-old daughter was missing. And a ransom note had been left in the house. The note was unusual from the start. 2.5 handwritten pages written on paper from inside the Ramsey home, demanding a strangely specific dollar amount. The responding officers arrived and treated it as a kidnapping. They cordoned off JonBenet's bedroom with crime scene tape to preserve whatever her abductor might have left behind. But they didn't seal the rest of the house. They left it wide open because in their framework, the crime was the kidnapping, not the house itself. That decision, made in the first hour by officers following the only protocol they knew, surrendered the crime scene. Friends arrived, family arrived, a minister came. Victims' advocates showed up with bagels. People moved through the living room, the kitchen, the hallways. They used the bathrooms. They touched surfaces. They left behind their own hair, their own fibers, their own DNA, all layered on top of whatever the killer had left behind. And nobody stopped them, because the officers in charge didn't understand that they were presiding over a murder scene. They thought they were managing a kidnapping. And you may be going, well, how did they? They didn't know at that moment that her body was in the basement. No, those first hours they didn't. But they did know that a kidnapper left a note right there in the house where they're all trampling around. That means the person was there. DNA technology was rather new at the moment. The ability to pick up specific fibers and identify them. And the way that we do this today is very different than we did it in 1996. So I will give them that. The foresight, the knowledge to what that scene may contain should have been top of mind without a doubt. I don't care if you've not done homicides or not. You're an officer, you're a detective. This should just be kind of like training manual 101 stuff. Hope you never have to do it, but it better be up there. Should you have to. And the complete abandonment of those basic principles of a potential crime scene, they just threw them out the window. I mean, I don't know. If ignorance is the right word to use, but it's something very close. Meanwhile, the actual investigative response was collapsing under its own weight. Officer Rick French searched the house in those early hours, looking for points of entry and exit. He reached a door in the basement, latched from the outside. He noticed the latch was on the wrong side for an exit. Figure no kidnapper would have left through a door that locked from the outside. Keep moving. He never opened it. Behind that door, JonBenet's body was lying on the floor. You know what they say, assumptions. Are you saying it out loud with me? Make an ass out of you and me. Remember hearing that? I heard that, yeah. Detective Linda Arndt arrived around 8 in the morning expecting to help manage the ransom call, but the call never came. The deadline of the note passed, and Arndt found herself alone, one detective, no backup, no real plan, sitting with a family in a house full of potential evidence that was being systematically contaminated by every person who walked through the door. By early afternoon, the forensics team had already packed up and left. Arndt, trying to give John Ramsey something to do, asked him to search the house one more time to see if anything seemed out of place. I don't know. That's kind of your job, isn't it? Like, to look in every possible room, not just assume. Yeah. John Ramsey went to the basement. He opened the door. Officer French had skipped. He found his daughter. She was lying on the floor with duct tape over her mouth, a cord around her wrists and neck. Her body was covered in a white blanket. Ramsey picked her up and carried her upstairs. He removed the duct tape. He loosened the cord. In his grief and horror, he did what any father would do. He held his child. And in doing so, he destroyed the single most critical forensic scene in the case. I'm not faulting him for that. It is what it is. Everything that happened next was built on a foundation that had already cracked. The gratchet used to strangle JonBenet was fashioned from a broken paintbrush belonging to Patsy Ramsey. The ransom note couldn't be definitively attributed. Handwriting experts eliminated over 70 individuals but couldn't rule out Patsy. And I know there's a lot of people out there who's got a lot of opinions about this. Take a look at the handwriting. Take a look at it. There are places, and this has been rehashed a gazillion times to Tuesday since 1996. There is a striking similarity, in my opinion, to Patsy Ramsey's handwriting and the handwriting on that note. Is it exact? Is it her? I don't know. I have no idea. But I tell you, it's a striking similarity in a lot of ways, in my opinion, and in the opinion of a lot of experts. Am I saying she did it? No, I'm not. I have no idea. But there is something going on in this case that is a twist and a turn that I don't think anyone sees. Including myself. I don't know. I'm not saying I know what that twist or that turn is. But there is something here. Does it involve Patsy? Is anything to do with it? I don't know. I don't know. But I do think there is someone somewhere in this case that maybe if it ever comes to light, maybe if we ever get the answers, we're like, oh, well, I didn't see that one coming. You may have an opinion on this. That's maybe why you're here. A lot of people still very vehemently follow this case, and rightfully so. And if you have an opinion and a thought, I'd love to hear it in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. I am not here to tell you I think she did it, he did it, anybody did it. I don't know who did it. I do not know. And I'm not accusing anyone either. I'm not accusing the family or anything like that. I'm just saying I don't know. And we don't have any answers. So at this point, I know. I think anybody will take anything that makes any modicum of sense here. There were trace amounts of unknown male DNA found on the clothing, but given the parade of visitors who had moved through the house that morning, any defense attorney in the country could argue contamination, and they did. The physical evidence, whatever might have told the true story of what happened in that house, had been compromised before anyone with the expertise to protect it ever set foot inside. And here's where it goes from tragic to inexcusable. It wasn't just that Boulder PD was in over its head. It's that the department refused every hand extended to help. Here's where the ultimate failures come in, where you can forgive the inexperience, but when it's time to go, I'm in over my head, could I get some help here? The arrogance, the ego, that sort of bullshit reared its ugly head. Denver PD offered experienced homicide detectives immediately. These were investigators who had worked many cases, real ones, complicated ones, that had required discipline and expertise from the first hour. Boulder said no. The FBI offered assistance. Boulder said no. The Colorado Bureau of Investigation was available. Boulder said no. John Ramsey himself would later say that the fundamental flaw in the entire case was a refusal to accept experienced help from the outside. He was not wrong. The department didn't just lack experience, it actively chose to reject the people who had it. This wasn't a resource problem. Those resources were offered repeatedly from multiple agencies. This was pride, institutional ego, a department that couldn't admit it was drowning even as the water rose around it. Sound like any place you know? Pima County? And the dysfunction didn't stop at the crime scene. The Boulder County District Attorney's Office, apparently distrusting the police department's ability to manage the investigation, hired its own set of investigators. Those investigators then worked at cross purposes with Boulder PD, sharing police files and physical evidence with the Ramsey's family's defense attorneys, insisting that detectives treat the Ramseys as victims rather than persons of interest. The DA preferred the intruder theory. The police were building a case against the parents. Neither side was coordinating with the other. The investigation became a turf war between two entities that should have been on the same team, with the evidence caught in the middle. Forensic investigators spent only 2 hours initially collecting evidence from the crime scene. 2 hours! An assistant district attorney at the time deemed that insufficient, and it was catastrophically so. But by the time anyone with authority recognized the problem, the house had already been overrun, the body had been moved, and the most critical forensic window had closed. In 1999, a grand jury voted to indict John and Patsy Ramsey on charges of child abuse, resulting in the death and being accessories to a crime. The district attorney chose not to prosecute. He didn't file charges, and he didn't even disclose the indictment to the public. That fact, that a grand jury voted to indict and the DA quietly buried it, would not become public knowledge for 14 years. In 2008, the Ramseys were formally exonerated based on new DNA analysis, kind of. Patsy Ramsey didn't live to see it. She died of ovarian cancer in 2006, having spent the last decade of her life under a cloud of public suspicion that properly closed and preserved evidence might have lifted years earlier. John Ramsey is now in his 80s. Still pushing for answers, still urging the department to use genetic genealogy and advanced DNA technology to identify the unknown male profile found on his daughter's clothing. Still begging the department to do its effing job. Here's the Nancy Guthrie case should be ringing in your ears. In Tucson, the questions about the initial investigation have centered on personnel. Whether qualified people were in the right seats during the most critical hours. Whether veteran detectives who could have contributed were sidelined. Whether the search was resourced by competence or by loyalty. In Boulder, the qualified people weren't sidelined. They were standing at the door offering help and being turned away. Denver's homicide detectives, the FBI, the CBI, every one of them was available. Every one of them was refused. The mechanism was different. In Tucson, it looks like the wrong people were chosen. In Boulder, the right people were rejected. But the outcome is identical. The first hours are lost, the evidence is compromised, and the families are left fighting a system that failed them before the investigation even started. The Boulder Police Department has since processed more than 1,500 pieces of evidence. They've analyzed over 200 DNA samples. They've followed up on more than 21,000 tips, traveled to 19 states, and spoken with over 1,000 individuals connected to the case. A new detective has been assigned, someone described as running the investigation like a sprinter. And maybe he'll crack it. Maybe genetic genealogy will finally put a name to the unknown DNA, but every single one of those efforts is built on a foundation that was damaged beyond repair in the first 6 hours of December 26, 1996, by the wrong people making the wrong calls in a house they should never have been trusted to manage alone. Some cases go cold because the killer is sophisticated. Some go cold because the evidence simply isn't there. And some go cold because the people who were supposed to protect the evidence decided they didn't need help. JonBenet Ramsey's case didn't go cold on its own. It was made cold in a kitchen. Someone wiped clean behind a basement door nobody opened. And in a phone call to Denver that was never returned. 29 years later, the department is still trying to solve a case that the department itself made unsolvable. And that's the thing about the wrong people in the room. They don't always know they're wrong. They're doing their best, they think, some. They're following procedure. They're making decisions that feel reasonable in the moment. When the moment demands more than they have, and the help is right there, one call away, and the answer is no, then the failure isn't about ability anymore. It's about ego. And ego doesn't preserve evidence. It doesn't secure crime scenes. It doesn't find killers. It just makes sure that the people who could have done those things never got the chance. JonBenet Ramsey was 6 years old. She liked performing. She won beauty pageants. She had a gap-toothed smile and a big personality to life that should have stretched decades ahead of her. She deserved an investigation run by people who knew what they were doing, or at least by people willing to admit they didn't. She got neither. And nearly three decades later, the person who killed her has never been held accountable. Not because the evidence didn't exist, because the people in the room let it slip through their fingers and then told everyone else they had it handled. This is part one of Beyond Nancy, exposing incompetent investigations. And if you think the JonBenet case is the worst example of what happens when unqualified hands touch the evidence first, I promise you, we are just getting started. Press subscribe. There's more to come all this week as we compare and contrast the Guthrie investigation against many other failed investigations and take a look at those critical first steps that are complete and utter misses. Again, your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. An interesting thought when I was doing that, when I was reading that, JonBenet Ramsey, be what, 35-ish today? Less than 10 years younger than me. Yeah, I mean, picture, I mean, everybody, you know, we remember her as a 7-year-old, you know? She's around my age. Pretty close to. It's kind of puts it into perspective how long ago that was, and still to this day, no answers. A lot of what could have been. We'll continue the conversation in the comments. The links are in the descriptions. My name is Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.